From London, England, Mutual now brings you a summary of the statements made today to the British Parliament by Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain and former War Secretary Leslie Hore-Belisha concerning Mr. Hore-Belisha's recent resignation from the British Cabinet. This broadcast comes to you through the courtesy of the British Broadcasting Corporation. We take you now to London, England. One moment, please.
War in the House of Commons this afternoon, Mr. Chamberlain referred to activity on land, sea, and in the air, and described the latest phases of our collaboration with France and the Empire. He said that offensive patrols had been carried out by aircraft over German seaplane bases every night throughout the hours of darkness when weather conditions allowed. When lights were exposed to enable German seaplanes to take off, our machines had dropped bombs and enforced a rigid blackout. In the last month, air activity had been hampered by short daylight, high winds, frost and fog. Yet our air forces had been continually in action over the North Sea. Every week, bombers swept the Heligoland Bight and the approaches to the Baltic in search of any German ships which might venture to sea. Long-distance reconnaissance had been extended to eastern Germany, Austria, and Bohemia. In the war at sea, the lack of success of the U-boat campaign had been followed by indiscriminate strewing of mines. But this latest threat was already coming under control and would presently be defeated. We had been horrified by the calculated brutality of air attacks on unarmed trawlers and against a lightship and a Trinity House tender. Mr. Chamberlain said these attacks were an outrage wholly incompatible with the universally accepted principles of warfare between civilized peoples. On land, there had been no major engagements, but British troops in the Maginot Line had taken their full share of patrolling and artillery fire. Mr. Chamberlain disclosed that the financial agreement with France had now led to a joint purchasing organization in America, thus achieving even closer cooperation between the two countries. He hoped this would lead to closer relations between the nations of Europe and of the world, and so facilitate peaceful reconstruction after the war. Speaking of the Empire's war effort, Mr. Chamberlain said that the special forces raised in Australia and New Zealand had now received intensive training and would shortly take their places where they were needed most. Agreements have been reached on details of the Empire air training scheme, and there was now no obstacle to the development of that great enterprise. Newfoundland had recruited several hundred men for patrol duty in the Royal Navy and was raising many more. In India, more people had offered themselves for enlistment than could be accepted at present. In Palestine, despite an intensive drive by the German Ministry of Propaganda, the situation was now calmer than it had been for some years. Mr. Chamberlain announced that export licenses are being granted for the release of war material to Finland, subject to our own war need. He assured the House that the amounts of war material were substantial. Turning to Japan, the Prime Minister said there was no sign yet of a peaceful settlement about China, but the government welcomed the relaxing by the Japanese government of some of the restrictions which caused difficulty and tension with third powers. Finally, Mr. Chamberlain said, at the moment there is a lull in the operations of war, but at any time that lull may be sharply broken. Events may occur within a few weeks or even a few hours, which will reshape the history of the world. We hope that just and lasting peace will not be long delayed. But it may well be that the war is about to enter upon a more acute phase. If that should prove to be the case, we are ready for it. Mr. Horvalisa, former Secretary of State for War, in accordance with the custom of the House of Commons, made his statement as retiring minister this afternoon. And this was followed by a statement by the Prime Minister, Mr. Neville Chamberlain. Both statements emphasized the subordination of personal considerations to the one object of an early and successful conclusion to the war. Mr. Horvalisa referred to the reforms introduced in the army during the past 2.5 years and said they had been carried out with a degree of agreement that offered a remarkable contrast to the stormy history of most reforms. I did not select my collaborators, said Mr. Horvalisa, because they were complacent or supinely acquiescent. I selected the strongest men I could find, and I respected them most when they were most outspoken in council. If there had been any differences of opinion, they have been no deeper than must occur in any association of men bent on pressing tasks. Our achievement has been neither the sole inspiration nor the exclusive result of any one of us. Particularly is this so in regard to what has been called the democratization of the army. This year there may be as many as 3 million men under arms, and I have always thought upon it as an ideal that the army should be a part of the nation and not apart from the nation, that it should be a career in which every young man could enter with the knowledge that he could rise by his character and ability regardless of his status or his means. I had hoped that in some way we might thus gradually bind all the members of the nation more closely in mutual understanding. At any rate, I worked for that, and those who were associated with me worked with me. It did not occur to me that we were making the army too democratic to fight for democracy. There had been, so far as he knew, continued Mr. Horvalisa, no conflict of views or policy with any of his colleagues in the government. The Prime Minister, he said, will recognize that I have relied upon his support in the task of preparing the army for war. And I acknowledge that until Thursday week last, it was readily forthcoming. The former minister next emphasized the right of the Prime Minister to make such appointments as he thought good, and also the duty of others to accept such posts, if by doing so they could give their best services to the state. Why then, he said, did I decline to accept the post the Prime Minister offered? I did so because I could not feel the assurance that the consideration which had persuaded the Prime Minister to make the exchange would allow of my energetic discharge in the national interest of any other office. The Prime Minister then spoke, and referring to Mr. Horvalisa's resignation, he said a number of rumours had arisen which were unfounded. First, he said, there had been no difference of policy between Mr. Horvalisa and his colleagues. It ought to have been obvious that the resignation could not be connected with any reforms which have taken place in the army system since he held office, because all those changes have been approved by the cabinet which shared the responsibility. The House could rest fully assured, continued Mr. Chamberlain, that no change of army policy was to be expected. There was no foundation whatever for the suggestion that the resignation was connected with or was the result of a battle between Mr. Horvalisa and certain high officers over the system of promotion in the army. I have never heard, said the Prime Minister, of any serious difference between Mr. Horvalisa and the Army Council. I do not believe that any has ever existed. To suggest that there had been pressure by military officers or by their friends on the Prime Minister to displace Mr. Horvalisa, or that the Prime Minister had been faced with displacing Mr. Horvalisa or receiving the resignations of high military officers was mischievous invention. No serving officer had at any time ever said one word to him, continued Mr. Chamberlain, but in the Secretary of State for War. Coming to the question of why he made the change, Mr. Chamberlain said, every Prime Minister must, from time to time, review the allocation of offices among his various colleagues and consider whether that allocation remains the best that can be effected. If the man holding that office had to make public all his reasons for making such changes, it would be impossible to make any change. Therefore, said the Prime Minister, I do not propose to give the House in detail my reasons this afternoon. I will only say that I have become aware of difficulties. Perhaps I might describe them as arising out of the very great qualities of Mr. Hall-Belisha. Mr. Chamberlain ended his reference to Mr. Hall-Belisha by saying, I deeply appreciate the tone and spirit of what was said by Mr. Hall-Belisha. He has put before all personal considerations one object, which should be the object of every one of us, the service of the country for the purpose of winning the war. I know he is anxious to make his contribution towards that object, and I trust it may not be long before he finds opportunity to do so. Mr. Attlee, leader of the Labour opposition, said it was extremely difficult for anyone not in the government to form a judgment. This was a matter where the Prime Minister must take responsibility. Sir Archibald Sinclair, opposition Liberal, said that too much had been made of the personal aspect of the resignation. The only thing that mattered was the vigorous prosecution of the war. Continuing this news from London, the Secretary of the Admiralty regrets to announce that during the past week, three British submarines have failed to return to their bases or to report, and it is feared they must now be regarded as lost. They are the Starfish, Undine, and Seahorse, and the Admiralty communique says that all three submarines have been engaged on particularly hazardous service.
From London, England, during the presentation of the regular BBC news broadcast, Mutual has brought you a summary of the statements made today to the British Parliament by Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain and former War Secretary Leslie Hall-Belisha concerning Mr. Hall-Belisha's recent resignation from the British Cabinet. The broadcast is presented through the courtesy of the British Broadcasting Corporation.